This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Three young men and an AR-15 semi-automatic rifle collide at a normal apartment building. Two are dead and the others in jail.
The concept of gun violence and violence in general is a problem in everybody's community. I'm here to tell you the entire country has a violence problem.
GLT teams up with the Pantograph for a closer look at the Lancaster Heights shooting and what police say is a troubling trend of young people with powerful stolen guns. The WBRP is celebrating a decade of service on the West Side. Learn more during an edition of GLT's Datebook. And hear about a new study co-authored by an ISU professor indicating electricity rate increases have a big impact on lower-income households. All of that and a GLT News update on the way. It's Monday, June 25th, 2018. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Seven people have been killed in gun violence in Bloomington Normal in less than 2 months. The most recent was just last week on Riley Drive. The first of these killings was back on April 25th. GLT's Ryan Denham teamed up with Edith Brady Lunny of the Pantograph to dig into that case, finding what police say is a troubling trend of young men and stolen guns.
Jody Gardner and Reggie Hart Jr. go to visit 17-year-old Chris Harrison on a Wednesday night. Soon, the narrow hallway outside Harrison's family apartment in Normal fills with gunfire, just feet away from families with kids up late watching cartoons. Neighbors call 911.
MatCom 911, what is the address of your emergency?
1444 East Talledge Avenue.
Okay, what's going on there?
It's directly above me. There's a whole lot of commotion and running, and there was a long series of bangs, possible gunshots.
Harrison chases his visitors into a nearby stairwell, where authorities say he fired more than 20 rounds into their bodies from an AR-15. When it was over, Gardner and Hart were dead. Harrison allegedly points police to a trash bag in an apartment containing the AR-15, a handgun, and a shotgun. They also find 190 grams of pot, scales, and packaging materials. Here's Normal Police Chief Rick Bleichner the day after it happened.
There was still smoke hanging in the air from this occurring. This was something that occurred very recently before the officers had arrived.
Police haven't disclosed a motive or what brought all three men into that pressure cooker environment the night of April 25th. 6 weeks later and 2 miles away in Bloomington, two other young people were slain by gun violence in an apparently unrelated incident. Three more were shot and killed a week ago on Riley Drive in Bloomington. Seven fatal shootings in less than 2 months.
A joint investigation by the Pantograph and GLT reveals the three men involved in April's shooting at Lancaster Heights each passed through a community safety net intended to stop at-risk youth from reaching the point of no return. But when youths are able to access stolen semi-automatic rifles, the consequences turn deadly that much quicker.
Edith, I want to pause the story here and talk a little bit about what drew us into it in the first place. For me, it was pretty simple. What was a 17-year-old doing with an AR-15, as police alleged? How did that happen? What about you?
Well, those questions intrigued me as well. I also think there's too little attention paid to what leads to this unprecedented violence. There's often a pattern of what's missing from people's lives, despite the best efforts of community organizations and the juvenile justice system.
First, though, it was important for us to learn a little bit more about the three young men tied up in this shooting at Lancaster Heights on April 25th. Chris Harrison had little contact with the law before his arrest on homicide charges. His mother, Nora, attended college, completed a master's degree. In her comments to juvenile court services when Harrison was sentenced for possession of alcohol by a minor, she described her son as goofy, funny, caring, and protective of his family. As part of the alcohol violation, Harrison participated in Normal Police's youth intervention program for at-risk kids in 2015. Court records show Harrison was diagnosed with ADHD in junior high and struggled at Normal Community High School. His mother told juvenile court services the school was geared, quote, toward two-parent families. He enrolled in Youth Build, an alternative school for kids who can't finish high school.
And Jody Gardner's journey to that apartment complex wasn't any easier. Gardner's life began when he was pulled from a dumpster shortly after birth by Chicago police and handed over to his great-grandmother, who raised him for the first 12 years or so of his life. His on-again, off-again relationship with his mother brought him to Bloomington Normal in 2010. When he attended school consistently and was not using drugs, records show he was an honor roll student. But records also show he was suspended repeatedly from NCHS for smoking pot and stealing. In 2014, he was held at a juvenile detention center after being accused of stealing a bike.
There's this quote from the court records that we thought was really telling. Jody Gardner was 16 at the time. He's talking to court services staff.
Yes, that's when he says, quote, "I've had time to think in here and nothing has distracted me. And I've decided that I don't want to be locked up, so I better start doing good," unquote.
Court documents and interviews with family and friends show Gardner wasn't content where he was. Like Harrison, Gardner enrolled in Youth Build and became its poster child. He was an aspiring rapper, and before he died at age 20, he enrolled at Heartland Community College with hopes of becoming a welder. One of Gardner's childhood friends was Reggie Hart Jr., who was 20 when he died. I spoke to Gardner's girlfriend, who was pregnant with his child. She says that Jody and Reggie were like glue, inseparable.
Juvenile court records show Hart displayed behavioral problems starting as a toddler at age 3. By first grade, he was diagnosed with ADHD but resisted medication. According to the court records, as a 9-year-old, he tried to choke his mother with a bungee cord and was diagnosed with oppositional defiant disorder. Records show Hart was moved to the regional alternative school in 7th grade because of ongoing disciplinary issues.
His court file shows his parents knew him differently, as someone who loved sports and played football, who was playful, outgoing, and knew the difference between right and wrong. Hart and Gardner's friendship got them into trouble before. Both were caught up in a theft case in 2012, and Hart's mother asked the court to keep the two boys away from each other using a so-called no-contact order. It's normally used to separate victims from perpetrators. All three were protected by, but escaped from, an array of community programs designed to help them. Here's Normal Police Chief Rick Bleichner again.
And the community in general has a whole host of different options that are available to youth. And I think this community has a lot of resources that focus on options for youth. Now, could we have more? We certainly could. At some point, it's a choice for youth that they have to make, and they have to want to have that help.
Their lives brought them together at Lancaster Heights. Police say the apartment complex is no hotbed of criminal activity. It's popular with families, with children, walking distance from a Target, Kroger, and several churches. Police reports show the building at 1444 East College Avenue, where Gardner and Hart died, has no recent history of serious crime. Authorities say the dispute was possibly drug-related, and Harrison faces drug charges on top of the murder counts. Edith, you spoke with Harrison's public defender, Carla Barnes. What did she have to say?
Carla declined to comment on the specifics of the pending case, including whether Harrison will claim self-defense. Authorities say Harrison fired the AR-15, but how he allegedly acquired the handgun and shotgun isn't clear. Carla said something very telling, though. She said, quote, "We've just started reviewing the materials from the state. We ask people to be patient. There may be more to the story."
When I spoke to Jody Gardner's girlfriend, she said Gardner and Hart were feuding with Harrison in the week leading up to their deaths. She says she had a bad feeling something bad was going to happen to him. The day after the shooting, Normal Police Chief Rick Bleichner called it a senseless act.
The thing that frustrates me is the finality of actions taken by individuals for, when you dig right down to it, something that really didn't amount to that. Individuals that find a permanent solution to a temporary problem.
An AR-15 is a very permanent solution, especially in the hands of a 17-year-old. Police say there's a noticeable shift in gun culture among local youths, from hybrid gangs passing around a shared gun, to each kid wanting his own gun, to now each kid wanting multiple guns. This year alone, Bloomington police has seen 5 examples of 3 different gangs posting on social media with long guns. Those are weapons that are not handguns or shotguns.
We went and visited Bloomington police crime analyst Jack McQueen. He says youths have become hyper-infatuated with weapons.
We now know they possess them, and obviously they're not old enough to have them, and it's not common for them to have them in their possession at all. So something's changing again for us as we watch these groups. And I don't want to, we don't want to comment on their case, but, right. you know, it fits in with that. Right. Where you've got a kid or a young adult that's infatuated with the use and possession of handguns and now has moved on to long guns.
McLean County State's Attorney Jason Chambers has seen a similar trend. Here's Chambers last fall on GLT's Sound Ideas.
The age of the people that we see. So for me, the concern that I have is not an increase in amount. It's the lowering in the age of people I see with the guns committing crimes. I mean, when you're talking about, you know, sometimes we've got 15, 16-year-olds running around with stolen handguns. That's a problem.
Jack McQueen says that social media has made it easier for kids to show off their gun or escalate disputes. He says a local judge even recently ordered a youth to refrain from posting certain types of content on social media. Edith, you talked to a guy named Art Feldman. He's a public defender who represents juveniles in criminal cases. What did he say about these types of orders and similar ones that keep two at-risk friends apart?
Feldman said it's an almost impossible task. Some of these youths are as close as family, if not closer, in Feldman's view. They can't be watched every minute, and then there's a challenge of social media.
Harrison is charged with illegally possessing three stolen guns, including the AR-15. Police say that's common. Most guns and crimes are stolen. But few stolen guns are ever recovered. Jack McQueen says in Bloomington, only 10-15% of reported stolen or lost guns are ever recovered. The same is true in Normal. McQueen says about one-third of stolen guns are taken from homes, another third from vehicles. Expensive long guns like AR-15s are especially attractive. AR-15-style weapons have been used in most all of the deadliest shootings this decade. We sent a Freedom of Information Act request off to Bloomington Police, Normal Police, and the McLean County Sheriff's Department. We were looking for any police reports of someone reporting a gun stolen or lost, something they're legally obligated to do when that happens. We got back some really interesting reports. My personal favorite was last fall when a Carlock resident told sheriff's deputies his AR-15 and a companion grenade launcher went missing from an unlocked gun case in an unlocked home. That gun and launcher, valued at about $2,400, remain missing.
In another example that stood out to me, Bloomington police investigated a stolen vehicle that included the theft of four guns. The car was found in Chicago, but the guns are still missing. At some point, it's more than possible that those weapons will be used in crimes.
Since we began reporting this story, there have been two other deadly shooting incidents in Bloomington Normal. The one on June 10th in East Bloomington, the other on Riley Drive just last week. Based on what police have told us, there's a high probability those people were killed with stolen guns. The two people killed on June 10th were 20-year-old Tanisha Brown and 18-year-old Stephen Alexander. Both lived in Bloomington. Their families are questioning why there's such easy access to guns. Brown's mother, Angel Hoskins, told my GLT colleague Charlie Schlenker, "Where are they getting all these guns from? It's baffling me." Gaynett Hoskins is Brown's aunt. Hoskins says the shooting reveals a lack of neighborhood togetherness.
Everybody right now is so focused on themselves. It's not a community anymore. It's an individual, and we are not going to make it as a community if everybody is looking at, oh, that's their problem.
Harrison is due back in court August 6th. He turned 18 on June 1st and was moved from the juvenile detention center to the McLean County Jail.
GLT's Ryan Denham and the Pantograph's Edith Brady Lunny reporting on a fatal shooting in Normal on April 25th. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. They continue the story with a closer look at what today's powerful guns can do to the human body.
Together, we've been taking a closer look at the fatal shooting of Jody Gardner and Reggie Hart on April 25th in Normal. Authorities say they were shot and killed by a 17-year-old carrying an AR-15. That's a semi-automatic rifle. One of the things we wanted to do was find out what happens to your body when you're shot with that kind of gun. Edith, one of the people we spoke to was Dr. Shayla Garrett Hauser.
That's right. Dr. Garrett Hauser spent more than 25 years at a Level 1 trauma center in Oak Lawn near Chicago before coming to Normal. She's treated hundreds of gunshot victims, ranging from the survivable to those that don't make it because of the serious injuries caused by more powerful weapons now used in those shootings.
She talked about going to visit schools all the time to talk about her job, and she says that kids always ask her the same question, you know, tell them about the grossest thing she's ever seen. She says that's easy. It was two decades ago, staring down at a very much alive woman with a bullet hole in her forehead.
And I'm like, oh, that doesn't look right. It doesn't look right. And I mean, the more she's getting upset, the more her brain is swelling. And suddenly a piece of her skull pops off and hits the floor. And I'm like, somebody should pick that up. We might need it later. But she's still talking. But that was that's what a 22 will do for you. She was shot from relatively far away, and that's a survivable wound. And now I think about how long has it been since I've seen that kind of thing, and the answer is 25 years, because we don't see those guns anymore.
What she means is many were survivable wounds until recently. The rise of more powerful weaponry in the U.S. has simply made it harder to survive being shot. A bullet leaves an AR-15 at three times the speed of a 9mm handgun bullet.
So you're talking just huge increases of the amount of energy that the body is going to take. To survive a true shot with an AR-15, that's a small miracle. And you can imagine what would happen in a school with small children. Someone comes in with that type of weapon. There are not open caskets, because these are people who are cut in half.
Authorities say Jody Gardner was shot 13 times, including 9 rounds to the back of his head and back. Reggie Hart suffered 8 gunshot wounds to his head, neck, back, and legs. Bloomington police have seen a similar shift toward more powerful guns. Here's BPD crime analyst Jack McQueen again.
It's the physics behind the weapon. You know, a handgun of whatever caliber may or may not penetrate, you know, a car door and another car door. Our crime scene guys could tell you that. A rifle of any quality or caliber is a whole nother animal for the level of danger, because you miss your target, and it's going to keep going.
Garen Hauser is not the only doctor concerned about gun violence. The American Medical Association this month adopted sweeping measures aimed at reducing gun violence, a problem it considers a public health crisis. At its annual policymaking meeting in Chicago, the AMA voted to press for a ban on assault weapons and came out against arming teachers. The meeting comes against the backdrop of recurrent school shootings, everyday street violence, and rising suicide rates in the U.S. Doctors say they're frustrated with lawmakers' inaction on gun violence. Here's Dr. Garrett Hauser.
Unfortunately, I think as healthcare providers, we become numb to it too. It just becomes the new norm, much in the way that we talked about how I feel like we have a violence problem. People think it's normal. Nowadays, someone that shoots up a school, we say, oh, that's sad. It's 8 hours of coverage. That's it on the news. And I think that's a really sad commentary as to where the society has gone as far as our tolerance for violence.
We spoke to the doctor right before she went on shift at the Broman ER. Garrett Hauser didn't just single out guns as the cause of gun violence. She described what she saw as a constellation of factors, from poor parenting to violence in video games. But guns are what bring mortally wounded human beings into her life, over and over again.
The concept of gun violence and violence in general is a problem in everybody's community. These school shootings are not happening in the urban inner city neighborhoods. These are happening in upper middle class neighborhoods. I'm here to tell you the entire country has a violence problem.
If you want to learn more about stolen guns in our community, go to WGLT.org and read over a few police reports we found, some interesting weapons that have gone missing in the past year in McLean County. For Edith Brady Lenny of The Pantograph, I'm Ryan Denham for GLT.
This is the second reporting partnership between GLT and The Pantograph. The first project focused on last December's fatal stabbing at a South Bloomington mobile home park. You're invited to a GLT community conversation about gun violence in Bloomington Normal Wednesday at 6 p.m. at ISU's Bone Student Center Prairie Room. Local community leaders discuss the issue and respond to your questions and solutions. Get details and learn more about the panelists at our community forum at our website, WGLT.org. You're listening to Sound Ideas. You may have noticed we stepped up our online game. The judges for the Illinois Associated Press Awards noticed too, recognizing GLT for best digital presence in the state. And they said they like how our stories and interviews are easy to find, and how photos are well connected to local stories, and that our website is a one-stop shop. GLT News is on air and online at Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. This is the award-winning GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.
Support for GLT comes from Westminster Village, helping individuals stay healthy and active in retirement through a variety of social and well-being activities. Wellness programs and on-site therapy services available. 2025 East Lincoln Street in Bloomington. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. A U.S. Supreme Court ruling last week means shoppers will more often be paying sales taxes for online purchases. It might also have meant a windfall for state government, but Illinois lawmakers anticipated the decision and already spent the money. On this week's Illinois Politics Roundtable, NPR Illinois' Sean Crawford moderates the panel with Charlie Wheeler of the University of Illinois at Springfield, IPR reporters Daisy Contreras and Brian Mackey, and Greg Hines from Crain's Chicago Business. Hines recaps what we know and don't know about the impact of the ruling.
The bottom line for consumers out there is the holiday's over, or it will be soon. The days when you can go on the internet and buy whatever you want, not pay sales tax on it, are coming to an end. The question is how much and how quickly. The legislature, in their own interesting little way, in May, before they adjourned, tucked into the budget package a measure to, in anticipation, the Supreme Court would what they just did, which is take away the requirement that a company had to be physically located in the state to charge sales tax. As a result, it would appear that from almost immediately, the state's portion of the sales tax, or technically it's a use tax, can now be collected. Now, in fact, has to be collected, that whether you have a physical location in the state or not, Amazon does, eBay doesn't. You have to start dinging your customers, and they now have to pay. That's a fairly considerable chunk of change. The legislature's actually already spent some of it in the wonderful Illinois way. They put $140 million in the new budget in anticipation of this revenue source. But I hear that eventually the figure could be much higher. I hear numbers up to like $500 million. It won't save Illinois taxpayers or the Treasury, but it will certainly help. What seems to be uncertain, though, is whether some additional legislation is going to be needed to help municipalities and agencies like the Regional Transportation Authority that impose their own tax on sales. It's not clear. There seems to be a pretty good debate behind the scenes as to whether what the legislature did covers them or not. So it is possible there will have to be a trailer bill that will be run this fall to fully let the municipalities and other local governments into the party.
So basically that local sales tax you might pay someplace, we don't know that that's included at this point.
Correct. And that could be as much as half of the take. I'm up here in Chicago, the city has a sales tax, the county has a sales tax, the RTA has a sales tax, and I believe the Metropolitan Pier and Exposition Authority has one. So it's a big chunk of change.
Brian, you followed this as well. And, of course, we've been hearing for so long, and we've been seeing brick-and-mortar stores shutting down. I know here in Springfield, for example, our mall is about to lose two of its main anchors. And we're seeing that across the state, really across the country. Is there some belief that this is going to work? I think we heard at the start of the show one person saying that maybe not, that Amazon has already been going along with some of this. So Amazon seems to be the big threat, and it may not make that much of a difference to these stores and where people work.
Yeah, that was State Representative Mike Zaleski, who's a Democrat from Chicago. He's chairman of the House Revenue Committee. And he basically makes the point that because Amazon, in what he called a sort of good corporate citizen move, they opened a lot of warehouses here a few years ago. They got a lot of tax breaks for those warehouses. And, of course, the state and city are looking to spend a lot more money on tax breaks to lure their second headquarters to Chicago. But setting that aside for the moment, because Amazon is already remitting sales taxes, Illinois does not stand to gain as much as other states where that might not be happening. And in fact, my understanding is that there was a federal GAO report that projected Illinois could get anywhere from $380 to north of $600 million in additional revenue. But my understanding from some state officials is that that figure would be as though we weren't already getting that money from Amazon. And that's why the more conservative estimate of state money coming in that Greg referred to, which was $200 million a year, prorated this year, because it's going to take a little bit more time to implement this. Is it too late to save brick and mortar? Well, as you said, we're seeing Bergner's, which is also known as Carson Peary Scott in other parts of the states. Those stores are closing across Illinois. We're seeing Sears stores closing across Illinois. It's too late for them. And whether it really levels the playing field, I mean, sales taxes, there is a measurable effect that research has shown that they does affect how people shop, whether they shop online or you know, they maybe go to a store and check out the features of a product or try some clothes on and then pull out their phone and order it from Amazon or some other retailer. Yes, that does happen. But there are a lot of other factors in terms of the convenience of having something show up at your door and things like that, that even this ruling is not going to change.
And Charlie, when we talk sales taxes, I think most people, they may not realize two of the biggest taxes really are the income tax and the sales tax that the state, you know, collects. This one's been under pressure for quite some time because of the growth of the internet. Your thoughts on what you heard this week?
Well, I think it's a matter of fairness because the store located physically in town is having to compete with someone who is in cyberspace, and because the person in cyberspace does not have to collect the so-called sales tax as the store in town does, they're able to offer better prices, lower prices. Now, in theory, the Illinois law requires you, if you buy something online, to add the sales tax to your income tax form when you file your income taxes.
There's a question, right?
Yeah, there's a question. You know, how much did you buy and what are you paying in sales tax? My guess is that there's, what, maybe a half of 1% of that of people who actually do that. So this can be a help, and it's not, as Greg said, it's not a ton of money. It is for an individual, you know, $200 million. Wow, that's like winning the lottery. But for a state that has the fiscal problems that we do and a budget the size that we do, that's like pocket change or rounding errors.
So, Greg, what?
And go ahead. I'm sorry. I was just going to just jump in on one more thing here. I'd like to, as Greg pointed out, and I like the headline that they put on his story, which is, you know, we're already spending this money. So here's this great windfall.
It's Illinois.
Yeah. Well, this just goes to show this is just something worth pausing on because of our budgeting practices. This was a 5-4 Supreme Court decision. That means it was a, you know, one vote away from going the other way, and that would have been yet another hole in the budget. So it just kind of shows the precarious nature of Illinois' finances.
But I would point out that even though it was only a 5-4 Supreme Court decision, betting on the come with that one was probably a lot more prudent and a lot more likely to happen than including once again selling the Thompson Center.
It's just yet another piece, yes, annual revenue source.
Well, before we move along here, Greg, let me just go back and just clarify from a public's point of view, what should they be looking for next to try to, again, get some clarity on this issue? What's some of the things that still need to be answered?
Well, the big question is whether additional legislation is going to be necessary to allow cities and villages and other local taxing bodies to impose this or not. I talked this morning with Brad Colt, the Municipal League. He's hearing different things, but he hopes to get a definitive answer by the end of the day, but certainly by the end of the weekend. If the ruling is you're going to need additional legislation, I guarantee you it'll be introduced and it'll probably pass because all these villages and towns, they need their money too. That's the main thing.
Greg Hines from Crane's Chicago Business, along with Charlie Wheeler of the University of Illinois at Springfield and NPR's Illinois' Brian Mackey and Daisy Contreras on the Illinois Politics Roundtable, moderated by Sean Crawford. You're listening to Sound Ideas on 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media. Coming up during Sound Ideas, hear about 10 years of the West Bloomington Revitalization Project. Charlie Schlenker has an edition of the GLT Datebook. That's still to come during Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. A recent study co-authored by an Illinois State University professor of economics shows how utility rate changes have a bigger impact on lower-income households than higher-income households. Dr. Adrienne Oler also works closely with the Illinois Commerce Commission. She tells GLT's John Norton that rate change studies tend to focus on price elasticity and how the average household responds to electricity rate increases.
What regulators of the electricity markets tend to be really interested in are how do price changes affect low-income households. So there's been a lot of studies that try to look at price elasticities, but they only do it, you know, on average. So what is the average household? How do they respond to a change in price? But what regulators are really concerned about is, well, how is this going to affect these low-income households? We know that high-income households can sort of withstand a price increase, and they will adapt and change their behavior. But it's sometimes harder for low-income households who, you know, very much rely on electricity for cooking and heating their houses.
So you found there was a difference on how low-income people and high-income people deal with rate changes, especially rate increases, I would imagine.
Yeah, it's mostly due to the appliance stock that they have in their household. So
they have less appliances in the house?
Correct. So high-income households have more TVs. They have bigger TVs. They tend to have a second refrigerator, and all of that consumes a lot of electricity. On the flip side, high-income households tend to use natural gas for space heating more, and for water heating as well. So low-income households rely on electricity much more for heating and space heating, and high-income household relies on it for their refrigeration and for entertainment purposes.
Sure. I would imagine there's a higher percentage of low-income people that don't have air conditioning, too.
Right. Right, and they don't have a dryer. So, and I
really?
Think, yes, and they tend to do fewer loads of laundry as well. So that's another way that they compensate, is they do laundry less often than really high-income households.
Okay, so you found that lower-income people react in a different way as well than higher-income people, not just because they have less appliances or whatever, but because maybe they adjust their heat, or if they have air conditioning, less or more?
Yeah, well, so they don't have the appliance, the AC unit.
So they don't have that energy, they're drawing that energy.
Right.
But also when they're heating their house, they tend to, like, keep it warmer?
So we're looking
or cooler, I guess. Cooler in the winter and warmer in the summer?
Yeah, so since we're looking at averages, both low-income households and high-income households know how to change their thermostat. So in order to save money, when the price of electricity goes up during the summer, then they're going to turn their AC up. So they're not going to use their AC as much.
Sure.
But that does require them to have an AC unit.
Okay.
So in terms of reducing your electricity usage, high-income households are able to do that through their AC unit, but low-income households cannot.
And this came up in your findings. That's not a totally surprising result, right?
Right.
So is this a change over maybe past studies that you have seen?
So the real added value of this study is to try to steer economists away from focusing on the elasticities. So we like looking at elasticities because it's a measure of how responsive people are in terms of a percentage change. A percentage change is not really a great way to compare the two high and low income households, because low income households start with less electricity use. And so if they're only using, let's say, 1,000 kilowatt hours per month, a 10% reduction is going to be 100 kilowatt hours. But for a high income household that's using, let's say, 2,000 kilowatt hours, a 10% reduction is going to lead to much more electricity use. So having the same amount of percentage changes doesn't lead to the same amount of actual electricity reduction.
Dr. Adrian Oler is a professor of economics at Illinois State University. I'm John Norton. This is GLT Sound Ideas. We're talking about her recently completed study on the effects of low-income versus high-income households on electricity rate changes. Another role you have at the university is as the director of outreach for the Institute for Regulatory Policy Studies. One of the things you do with that is to help organize a biannual conference with state regulators and utilities to understand these impacts, right? So from this study, how are you delivering the impact of this study to these regulators and to the utilities?
Well, oftentimes regulators are the chairman, the commissioners that are appointed to the ICC, they are appointed by the governor, and they're oftentimes not familiar with how electricity markets work.
So you don't need any special expertise to be on the
no.
ICC, is that what you're saying?
And one of my favorite commissioners right now used to work for Coca-Cola Company. He is extremely smart and outgoing, and is very interested in learning about the markets, and so that's, you know, what makes him a great commissioner. But they don't come in understanding public utility regulation. And so the purpose of that conference is really to educate them on what it is that the laws say that they can do and how to what is actually happening in the industry right now. Where the study comes in is that, you know, we can point to this study and say, if you're concerned about low-income households, this is what the appliance stock looks like for those low-income households, because they don't know that, right? They're just a normal consumer like you and I. Yeah.
So how does that affect regulators? How does that affect how they deal with utilities then?
Of the commissioners that are concerned about low-income households, which, you know, I think a fair amount of them are, you know, it is going to play into their decision-making very much so. And I think in some of the demand charges and pricing systems that have been proposed in the past, they were concerned enough about low-income households that, you know, they did not vote in favor of a rate increase or a change in that rate structure.
In your study, what else did you find? Were there any surprises that popped up?
The most interesting finding was that of the laundry. I think maybe that I didn't think that low-income households did their laundry differently than high-income households, but they do fewer loads of laundry, and so that was surprising and new information to me. That I knew that they had, you know, fewer TVs and smaller refrigerators. But the fact that they changed their habits in terms of how they do laundry was very surprising.
I was surprised to find out the cost of electricity is different during the day than it is during the evening.
Well, that is for wholesale prices, and that's a really interesting point that you make. So the retail prices that we pay are constant over the course of the day, but wholesale prices change. And that's not too surprising, because wholesale prices include wind and solar, and the wind tends to blow at night. It tends to blow more during the winter months here in Illinois. And so that actually drives prices down, because, you know, wind is such a free fuel source. I am one of the customers that Ameren serves with what's called Power Smart pricing. That's their hourly pricing structure. The rates for that change every hour. You can look 24 hours in advance as to what the next day's prices are going to be. And you can also get alerts when the price of electricity goes above 9 cents a kilowatt hour. You can be warned, you know, 24 hours in advance so that you don't run your AC as high. So I was looking at the prices of those for today, and they are between 2.5 to 3 cents a kilowatt hour, which is really a lot lower than what the city of Bloomington, the town of Normal, and what Ameren is offering at their flat rate.
So is that if you're buying from Ameren directly and not through the aggregation programs of
right.
the city and town?
Right. So you would have to opt out of participating in the municipal aggregation that both of the cities offer. But it's a way to be more engaged with your electricity and be more engaged with the markets, is knowing what the price of electricity is and being able to take advantage of when the wind is blowing. Tends to be at night, and so the price of electricity is lower then. And so that's when I run my dishwasher and I do laundry in the morning, because that's when the price of electricity is lower as
you
well.
You have opted out.
I have opted
okay.
out, yeah.
Oh, interesting. And so do you pay less then, because you're paying attention to all this, than if you would have stayed in?
So Ameren sends me a monthly update on how much money I save by not being on their rates.
Uh-huh.
So I tend to save 5 to 10% a month, which ends up being about $2 or $3 a month. Now, I'm on the low side of energy use. I only use about 800 kilowatt hours a month. That would be on a really extravagant month during the summer.
You're also on the high end of awareness as well. I mean, it's just part of your job and your interest in this. Most people don't have this depth of knowledge on where their electricity comes from, how the rates are determined. it's not like baseball or football or sports. We can see the standings, right? We can see the scores every day. How does someone who wants to be more aware, is it just going online, Googling things, or is there a way to keep track of things?
I think getting involved in the, Power Smart pricing is a really great way to start, because the price reflects changes in the market, both in terms of new renewable developments, but also changes in the structure of maybe how natural gas is being priced, or if that market becomes more volatile, that'll be picked up in the electricity market as well. And so, just being aware of how prices change over the course of the day and over the course of the year can make you more knowledgeable in what's going on in these markets.
Illinois State University economics professor Adrian Oler speaking with GLT's John Norton. Oler recommends Power Smart pricing for Ameren customers who want to be more engaged with their electricity pricing and usage. You're listening to Sound Ideas. The West Bloomington Revitalization Project is celebrating a decade, making life better for the West Side and the grand opening of its building on West Washington Street. Charlie Schlenker talks with project leader Armando Baez about the past 10 years.
Quite a bit. It's always changing, and it's neat that it started out with just a handful of individuals who wanted to bring change, and it's grown into what it is now, which is they're in a building. It's got tons of space, and they have 9 programs that are all in different areas. I'm one of a few paid employees, over the 10-year history. And other than us, it's all been volunteer-run. A dozen or two dozen people who have been very involved have kind of grown it from the beginnings to now. So in that sense, it's pretty amazing. But also on the other end, when I came in 6 months ago, there were a lot of things that had to be organized in different basic systems in place.
What is all that in aid of, that transition from a purely volunteer-driven and decentralized organization to one that has centralization and can pivot rather more quickly? Where should the organization be going?
That's something I want to be very aware of. I told Tawny, the president, when I came in, that was something I noticed, that it was decentralized, and I really like parts of that, and I want that to continue. So kind of keeping just a balance of both having a lot of people involved, but also having basically just a person to be there consistently, people recognize, but also to have, if you're looking for something, you know where to find it, just that organization side to it. But yeah, just having a balance, because there's so many beautiful, unpredictable things that happen when it's decentralized. But also, if you let that go for too long, it's really hard to focus the efforts if there's something that you really want to focus on.
So organizationally, how do you keep the best of each? What do you do?
I think just really communicating. So communicating with board members and founders and volunteers and people involved, knowing that, it's not just about me and what I want and the direction I want to take it, but really taking advice and information from many different places and kind of coming up with feeling what it is, what direction it should go.
With me is Armando Baez of the West Bloomington Revitalization Project, celebrating 10 years of doing interesting and important things on the west side of Bloomington to revitalize community and to provide for the common weal. How are you celebrating?
It started as a very modest, small kind of general grand opening for the building. And then slowly, as time went on, things got kind of added. So not only just the grand opening for WBRP, but also grand opening for the bike co-op and adding an open house so people can tour the place. And then we're like, oh, yeah, it's going to be our 10-year anniversary. So we added that on. And I think just a lot of other things, too, that have happened with the organization over the last 6 months, just when I've been there. There's so much to be happy about and grateful and thankful that it's I think we need to have kind of this large celebration, too, and to invite the community that we're in. And we kind of transformed it into just like a festival, kind of a party, with the intention of focusing on kind of the 10-year anniversary and the grand opening, but also moving forward, you know, I really want to make sure that we're staying true to listening to the residents, the voice of the residents. That's a huge part of the founding ideals of the organization, developing your programs and who you're serving, but also keeping in mind that, like, the intention and the basis of the organization was to empower the residents of West Bloomington. So we want to make sure, and this is kind of, this is definitely an ongoing process and just kind of revisiting each of our programs. But we want to make sure that those programs are in fact doing that. They're empowering, and that they're also serving Westside residents.
So give us the deets of the celebration.
Yeah. So it's June 30th. It's 5 to 8 o'clock, and it's called the West Bloomington Fest. And, basically it's going to be kind of like a street party, a block party kind of celebration. We're closing Allen Street off. So the street just right, west of the building, we're going to close it off for the stand to come in for the live music, or the stage, I mean. And then we're going to have a food truck and Carl's Ice Cream. There's going to be a bike giveaway. So just kind of in good WBRP fashion, we kind of have, you know, said we wanted to do a celebration, kind of grand opening party. And slowly, as we're planning, we're adding things to it. It kind of seems like the way of how we do things. It's typically like building the car as it's running. And that seems to work for us.
For example, tell us how the tool library is continuing on that process, in that mode.
Yeah, the tool library is it's definitely one of the more popular programs. It continues to grow, and I'm amazed at how many new members that we sign up, you know, every time we're open, and how people are just like hearing about it. There's so many things that you can do when you have tools. There's so many different projects and repairs, so it's just very far-reaching.
But you're adding a tool co-op as well, right?
Yeah, I guess you could call it like a tool co-op. The idea is it's a workshop kind of in the back, and we're slowly trying to bring it to a place where we can actually hold workshops and eventually teach people kind of woodworking skills. We have pretty much all the tools. We have a lot of the benches and tables. Right now we're kind of stuck. We need the dust collection system installed, and we've got the funds for the actual system, but we need it installed. So that's kind of what we're waiting on. And after that, we'll be able to invite people to come in, you know, cut their own wood, show people, like, you know, how they can build different pieces of furniture. There's so many different possibilities when you have just like this workshop that's open to the public. So yeah, it's definitely moving in the right direction. We just need just a little bit more push with finishing it up.
As with the tool library, as with the bike co-op, as with the veggie exchange, you have ideas, you have people with passion, get those projects going. They run successfully and grow to maturity. And then the challenge becomes finding new volunteers as the originators tire or age out or move on to new projects. How can you maintain the same fervor that began each individual initiative?
Yeah, that's something that I'm definitely aware of, and that we've talked about, the sustainability of programs. That's huge. I think with the start of any kind of new initiative or program, that has to be taken into account before anything is, you know, continued or launched. With a lot of our programs, they're fairly self-sustaining. And it has to do with kind of the initial organization of it. Right now, I would say of all the programs, we are having a really hard time. It's a challenging thing to keep the tool librarian position always occupied.
GLT's Charlie Schlenker talking with Armando Baez with the West Bloomington Revitalization Project. The WBRP is celebrating its 10th anniversary and the opening of new headquarters at 724 West Washington Street with a block party June 30th. There's free food and ice cream and much more. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. Our website, WGLT.org, is where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories with help today from John Norton, Charlie Schlenker, Ryan Denham, reporting with the Pantograph's Edith Brady Lunny. WGLT.org is the first place to go to subscribe to the Sound Ideas podcast. You can also look at Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or NPR One. We want to know what you think of Sound Ideas. Post comments at facebook.com/WGLTFM or tweet your comments. Use the hashtag Sound Ideas. We're all at WGLT News. I'm at Mike McCurdy. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.